I'm here with Bill Charla, who is an extraordinary musician and a pleasure to listen to. And I'm explaining to Bill that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Now, I have just identified you as a musician. Is that how you would think about yourself?
I suppose so, yes.
Well, you could add if there are other things you're noticing.
No, I'm not a short order cook or anything like that. I'm a musician.
Yeah, it's very, very clear. Okay, so I only ask one question.
All right.
And it is, can you remember, and if you can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when music attracted you, called you, felt good to you, came out of you, any of that?
Well, yes. I don't ever remember a time that music wasn't central to my life. And I don't ever remember a time that I didn't play the piano in some sort of way. I suppose what brought me to it was my father. My father was Moose Charlat, and he was a wonderful theater composer. He wrote, among other things, the score to Peter Pan. Songs like I Won't Grow Up, and I'm Flying, and I've Got a Crow. And he used to play and sing at the piano when he was composing. Now, he wasn't really a pianist or a singer, but the energy of his playing was so intense that I wanted to be like my dad. So I would try to imitate my dad at the piano. The very first thing I remember figuring out at the piano was I had an album, a record album, which was called Sparky's Magic Piano. And what it was a children's story about a child who takes piano lessons, and he has a dream that he becomes the world's greatest concert pianist. And in the dream, he goes on tour all over the world. Now, understand, this was not just a play, a radio play, essentially, but it had music behind it. And the music was, I found out later, written and orchestrated by Billy May, the great orchestrator. And it really was very, very good. It wasn't really jazz music, you know. It would have excerpts from classical pieces. For instance, Sparky's teacher would play for him, say, and now I'm going to play whatever it was. Maybe it was the Revolutionary Etude of Chopin or one of the posthumous waltzes or something like that. Anyway, at the very end of the album, Sparky is making his Carnegie Hall debut now. Now he's in his dreamland now. And, oh, the piano, I should mention this. In his dream, the piano says that it will play for Sparky. When you looked on the album, it said piano by Sonovox. Now, I don't know what that was, but I bet you it was an early vocoder. What a vocoder is a synthesizer that also can make speech. So the piano would play chords and speak and sing to Sparky. It was a really wonderful fantasy. And actually, the music was really well written. But what happens at Carnegie Hall, first of all, Sparky plays with the orchestra. Now, this isn't even an orchestral piece, but he plays the C-sharp minor prelude of Rachmaninoff, the very famous piece. You would all know it. It's really wonderful and theatrical, and there's an orchestral arrangement around it. Now, at the end, the audience goes berserk, and they ask for an encore, and Sparky says, okay, piano, what are we going to play? And the piano says, your time is up. I will no longer play for you. And now he has to play. Now Sparky freaks out and starts banging at the piano, does a full Cecil Taylor. And Sparky wakes up from the dream. And of course, the moral of the story is that you have to practice. And he said, I'm going to start practicing right now. Of course, it had to have a little 1950s moralism in it. But it really was terrific. And the point of the whole story is that I remember loving that piece, and I went to the piano with two fingers, and I went, ding, 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 bing, 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 ding, 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 ding. Now, those intervals, they're pretty advanced intervals for a young person to be hearing. And so at that point, of course, I'm sure my parents said, oh, something's going on there, you know. And that's the first time I remember approaching the piano and actually being able to do something that was musical.
Yes.
Two fingers.
How old were you?
2.5 or 3. Yeah, I was very little. My father would be writing something, and I remember also something that he wrote particularly was a film called Jack the Giant Killer. And Jack the Giant Killer was a B movie that never really made it. It was one of those kind of claymation things with big monsters that Jack killed the dragon. It was that sort of thing. And my father was working on this thing before he died called The Process. There was no computers or anything like that. This type of thing would have been much easier to do. But what they were doing is they were putting music to a film without music, turning it into a musical. And what he did was sort of, he took out all the scary bits where the monsters were killing the good guys. Only the good guys could kill the monsters. And he put things into song. So I Wish Peter Were Here to Celebrate With Us became I Wish Peter Were Here to Celebrate With Us, something like that. And it turned into a musical. And it was a song he wrote that had a bass line. I really remember this because it went doom, 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 doom. Bum 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 bum. And it kind of swung, said she sails through the morning tide, like that. And it was just, I really liked that. It was swinging, boom 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 boom. So I would play that. I remember, this is my first memories. You know, you're bringing all of that back. I haven't thought about that for a very long time.
Yeah, but they inform everything that comes after that. So you said, so I guess my parents thought something must be going on here. So did they then say, oh, lessons?
You know, nobody ever pushed me. It wasn't that kind of, we want you to be a prodigy and get to Carnegie Hall, you know, a meanie at 8, a genius at 7, and senile at 11. They didn't want that. That's Yip Harburg, by the way. But they weren't looking for that. I guess at one point I did start having a piano teacher, but again, I wasn't that serious. I really loved my lessons. And I remember my teacher was, her name was Miss Wright. Beverly Wright, who became my very good friend later, and one of my first managers, actually. She became a classical music manager. Not that I was geared towards being a classical musician, but she took me on very early on. I was her one jazz act. Anyway, I was more interested in charming Ms. Wright into playing the pieces for me, and then I could play them back for her. I was very fast and facile that way.
Okay, so you could play by ear.
Yes, everything.
Referencing the two finger thing, that you always could find it on the piano.
Always. In fact, I learned everything by ear at first. I did study later. When I say later, I mean by the time I was, you know, 10 years old or something like that.
Isn't it difficult when you know you can play it by ear to make yourself learn to read?
I was a terrible reader, and it took me such a long time to read, and I'm still not a fast sight reader. Luckily, because of that, I was able to learn to memorize things very quickly. Yes. And later, oh, I'll tell you one other thing about Miss Wright, which was wonderful. She took me to concerts. Now, that was really key. And I remember one very important one. There was a pianist called, I think I'm saying his name right, Amram Rigai, an Israeli pianist. He was playing at Carnegie Recital Hall, and he played Beethoven Appassionata, which, of course, is such a dramatic piece of music. And so much a piece of romantic piano music, although it's absolute sonata allegro, you know, it bridges that gap. Beethoven's shaking his fist at God like a true romantic. At the concert, I loved it. And there were two record albums for sale after the concert. This was important. Miss Wright was really smart. I wanted a copy of that Rigai playing the Beethoven Appassionata. So will you buy me that record, Miss Wright? There were two records. She said, no, I'm not going to get that one for you. He's recorded something else. She was thinking, if you're going to get the Appassionata, get Horowitz or get Rubinstein or get, you know, not that he wasn't a great pianist, but what he did that was special is he recorded an album, maybe the very first record album I owned that I didn't buy myself. It was the music of Godshaw, Louis Godshaw. Godshaw is a link. He was a Creole composer. He was the link to ragtime, the link between Chopin and ragtime. And he wrote a very famous piece called The Banjo. Goes bum 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 bum. Sounds like that. Sounds like a banjo. Sounds just like that. It's American music. It swings. But it's not. It's not yet syncopated music. It's not yet going, you know, bum 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 bum. It's not doing that yet, but it's opening the door for Joplin in a certain kind of way. So for a part of what jazz is, I'm not saying all of it. Of course, the other roots are, well, the main roots are in the drum and Africa and so many other things. But it was wise of her to buy me the Godshaw record. I didn't know any of this at the time. Obviously, I wasn't a historian and I wasn't thinking about any of that. But now I know how lucky I was to be exposed to that music. And she knew that, well, this is special. Everybody's not recording Godshaw's music. He should have this, not the Beethoven necessarily. That you can get anywhere. So okay, that was
so again, how old were you about then?
I had to be 8 or 9.
Okay. So far, most of the influences that you're having are pretty much classical, except for your dad.
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm listening to everything, and I don't know whether it's classical or jazz or what it is. It's just music to me. For instance, I had an album, I'll never forget this one. It was called The Nutty Squirrels. This was the jazz version of Alvin and the Chipmunks. And what it was the great mellophone and musician, arranger, composer, Don Elliott. The thing about this Nutty Squirrels record is the rhythm section was really good. Whatever it was, they were doing Alvin and the Chipmunks, but bebop, like doing tunes like Thelonious Monk's Nutty and Dizzy Gillespie's Salt Peanuts. And the solos were fantastic. Now, when I listen to them now, they're absolutely in the vernacular. The guys are swinging. They're playing very advanced solos. I mean, they're playing great bebop on it. But it was the sound of Alvin and the Chipmunks singing bebop. So, you know, I know it's kind of crazy, but those kind of things, they get inside of you and you don't really know what's going on. Of course, my father was also playing me classical music, being a composer and loving Bartok and Respighi and Ravel. And he was so theatrical. I remember sitting in the basement floor of a house that we were in during one summer. And he was playing the Bolero of Ravel. And he was narrating it as if, you know, you could see the procession and he was talking about it. And by the time it got very loud, he's screaming about, you know, there's camels and beautiful princes and princesses and jewels. And it was really, do you remember Back to the Future when the DeLorean is first revealed from the truck? And Spielberg does one of his wonderful moves. He flashes to the dog and the dog goes,
oh. Yes.
Well, that's rather what I felt like with my dad when he would talk about music in the way that he would. And especially I remember that feeling sitting on the basement floor. You know, he was loomed so large for me in that way. And the music was so large, but all kinds of music. My brother, Tommy, who's 9 years older than me, he was all about jazz and rock and roll. So, you know, he was listening to the Beatles. And my father particularly loved Within You, Without You. That spoke to him. That was, this is something really new. You know, the Indian influence that was there. And he really liked that a lot. So there's just a lot of music being played. And of course, my father's music, you know, original cast albums, Peter Pan, not just Peter Pan, but other shows, a lot of show music.
Yeah, well, clearly your father was theatrical.
Yeah, well, that was it. I mean, that was the center of was his universe, but also pop songwriting. He wrote songs for Joe Williams and Sarah Vaughan and Astrid Gilberto and many, many other people. My mom, of course, is a great singer, and she was, she toured with Benny Goodman. She was a regular on the Perry Como show and the Mitch Miller show and Grammy nominated in the 60s, Kendra and Ebb's first hit tune, which was My Coloring Book. So there was all of that music and but really song oriented, you know, in my house. I kind of grew up. But you asked about reading before. I just want to tell you, I really didn't get that together till a bit later. But I went to the High School for the Performing Arts, where that was a great place to go at that time. At that school, you had rich, poor, black, white, straight, gay, Asian, Russian, American, absolutely everything. And together by talent, gospel music, classical music, jazz, dancers, actors. It was intense. And it was New York City. You know, if you're one in a million, there's 10 of you in New York. So you had so much talent in one place. And my two best friends were Eleanor Bindman, and she's still a great pianist, and a Chung Ah Song. She was from Korea. Eleanor was from Latvia, just immigrated here. They were both monster virtuosos at that level. And I was not anywhere near that type of level of playing. Now, I could do my special thing, which was play stuff by ear and play with a certain rhythmic vitality and types of things that I could do. But at Performing Arts, I remember Chung Ah one time, we had a school orchestra and I had to play cello in the orchestra, which I enjoyed, but I was terrible at it because I didn't practice. And if I had an open string on a stretto section, that was great. I could really lay into it like I knew what I was doing. But I remember one time that Chung Ah sight read the piano part to the Brandenburg Concerto number 5 in D major of Bach. Now, this is, you have to understand, it's going, it's just moving and moving and moving and contrapuntal, and she's just sight reading it, you know. And I even remember the teacher who was, she seemed like she must have been about 80 years old at that point, and maybe she wasn't, but seemed that way to me. And she was conducting, and she dropped her baton and kind of went, it was shocking to see that kind of talent. And that's what I was surrounded by at Performing Arts. Not just classical musicians, but like I said, gospel musicians, jazz musicians, all kinds of things. The point I'm making is that show business oriented, I realized, oh, this is just not going to do. So I painstakingly learned a Mozart sonata note by note and memorized it, you know. And then I would just, you know, I'd show up to school, I'd take the music, throw it on the piano and pretend I was sight reading. Of course, I wasn't sight reading anything. I could have been reading the paper or eating a ham sandwich. But, you know, that was the thing. So I didn't really learn to do that until later.
Well, I guess before you went to high school, you'd already decided you were a musician. Is that right?
I guess I knew absolutely that I was a musician. That was never a question in my mind, I think. From as long as I can remember.
And choosing jazz.
I don't know that it was a matter of choosing it. It was more a natural development of the way that I was playing, because I was, again, playing everything by ear and playing theater music and show music and my idea of what classical music was. It sounds very pretentious, but I remember my audition for Performing Arts, and I said, well, what are you going to play now? I said, this is my adaptation of Ginastera's Piano Concerto. What it was my way of playing Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's Toccata, which was based on Ginastera's Piano Concerto, and I had figured out certain things about it. And at this point, I was kind of a long-haired hippie kid, and that's what I came in and played. But, you know, the answer is I was into all kinds of music, and then I discovered particularly progressive rock and roll and keyboard heroes like Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson. To me, that was it, you know. And my brother, who's a bass player and a wonderful bass player, he gave me a couple of albums. One was a George Shearing album and one was a Weather Report album, because he knew I liked synthesizers. So he said, well, I know you like those guys. You better check out Joe Zawinul. And of course, Joe Zawinul is the top in terms of using the synthesizer almost like an acoustic instrument. And that opened doors for me. And also in my parents' collection, there were a couple of other things. Records, particularly of Oscar Peterson, Ahmad Jamal, Clark Terry, and Bill Evans, importantly, Portrait and Jazz. And that was very arresting to me, particularly Someday My Prince Will Come, because I knew that from Snow White. And then I heard Bill play it. And the cover of the album was very arresting because it's just Bill's face head on, 1950s Bill, horn-rimmed glasses, serious, looking straight at you. And it looked so cool to me, you know? He looked so focused and intense. And everything about that, I think that was a game changer for me, hearing that music.
Okay, so you are bombarded by music from the beginning, right? It's all over the place.
Oh, you know what?
What?
This is important.
Mm-hmm.
You said, what's the first time I knew I wanted to play jazz? This is very important. I'm in the seventh or eighth grade at the town school, which is where I went to school in New York City. It was a small private school on 76th Street and the river, a very progressive thinking school, a good place, serious, focused, beautiful teachers, and a wonderful humane aesthetic that was there. And the principal at that time of the school, her name was Sarah Burke, and she was good friends with the drummer Eddie Locke. And Eddie Locke was a protege of Joe Jones, kind of the fountainhead of modern drumming, who was, Eddie Locke came to the school and played an assembly for us. He would play these, you know, they would have assemblies where we would have people come. David Barillon, I remember, a great concert pianist. His son was, Jeremy was one of the students there, and he came and he played Debussy's Children's Corner Suite. Unbelievable. I mean, magnificent pianist. But Eddie Locke came with a pianist called Johnny Morris. Now, this is at the time that the Sting was very hot. And Marvin Hamlisch had adapted Scott Joplin's music for the Sting, which was the perfect music. Also at that time, Joshua Rifkin, the great pianist, had made an album on Nonesuch of Joplin's music. There was a resurgence of Joplin's music at that time. Max Morath was also important there. All of these things were happening. Now, I didn't know it. I just loved the sound of Joplin's music and the sound of the entertainer, which was so swinging. And I remember Eddie came to school and they played Solace, which is central to the Sting. And Eddie, who was from Detroit, played the drums. And when Johnny Morris played, Eddie goes with a big smile. It's warm. And I said, oh, wow, that's really something. Okay. Go to maybe a year later, Eddie Locke now comes with a real jazz group. Johnny Morris wasn't really a jazz pianist. He was an eclectic piano player, but Eddie figured out how to make it all work. Just drums and piano, if I remember correctly. Now a new assembly comes. I'm sitting, everyone knows I'm all into music. So I'm now in the seventh or eighth grade. It was only first through eighth grade, this school. And they let me sit in the front with the first graders, crouched on down. And Eddie came with Roland Hanna at the piano and Major Holly at the bass. And you understand, these are major virtuosos. They came to school. Now I'm in eighth grade or so. Maybe I'm 12 years old, 11 years old. I'm 11. And they played, and you know, the music was so beautiful. And the way they all looked, they looked so cool. They looked like they were of another society. I remember Roland was like wearing these checked pants and like this jacket of a different color that I'd never seen. And I don't know, it was almost like I imagine a green shirt or something. Just everything about them was a different society. And of course, they're all African-American and they're smiling at each other while they're playing and laughing. And I remember hearing the music and thinking, that's the most beautiful music I ever heard. And I also remember another thing I thought. I said, it's really, really difficult. That sounds really, really hard, what they're doing. They have to know so much about music. Yet I knew it was extemporaneous. And also, they were playing these pieces with crazy titles. I had never heard anything like it. And I remember taking the bus home, and I got off the bus and I went home to my mom. And I said, "Mom, I heard a song today. It's called On Green Dolphin Street." Did you ever hear of something like that? Maybe that's why I'm thinking about green. And of course she had heard of On Green Dolphin. Right. But to me, it sounded, I'd never heard of a title like that. It really sounded very Peter Max, you know. It was quite trippy. And anyway, that was really, really important. It opened up a door, and not just because of the music, but because of that, Eddie became a real surrogate father to me later. Really, I became quite close with Eddie. I don't know how all of this happened, but it did. And he was a great nurturing force, and of course, a master drummer, but a true jazz man in every way, because he was not interested in technicality. That was part of it, of course. But he was always talking about, well, they're great musicians. These guys are really great musicians. They ain't playing no jazz or nothing, but they're great musicians. That was what he was taught, because he was talking about love on the bandstand. You know, is there some love on the bandstand? And he was that way. And I'll never forget, here I am, this kind of wild kid, after hearing that concert with Roland Hannah, I'm on my bicycle and I'm on Central Park West, driving uptown. I'm on about 84th Street, coming out of the park and now going uptown. And this big white station wagon, I remember, I think it was a station wagon. It's white and big, and there's Roland Hannah driving it. And I'm driving next to him, and he rolls down the window. He remembered me. He says, "Hey, baby, how you doing?" And it was just, you know, he remembered me. I couldn't believe it.
It was mystical.
Well, it really was.
I know.
And that idea that I mattered enough for him to say hello. You know, that's the thing. These really great Americans, these musicians, that meant something to me, you know. So that is the answer. That was what it is. Between the albums that I heard and that experience, and then my brother and the musicians he was playing with, and later him taking me to Hanratty's uptown, which was a solo piano joint. I mean, solo piano, Dave McKenna, Dick Hyman, you know, we went to hear Dick Hyman play. And I said to him, "Wow, I mean, do you think it's ever possible that I could ever play anything like that?" And I remember my brother's answer. It was like, I don't know. Because as Dick was just, and he's still the, you know, one of the angels at the top of the tree. I mean, he's 95 years old and he's still cleaning all of our clocks. And the answer is still, I don't know. So anyway, all of that was all central.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the music clearly was there from day one and was integral. And what you heard from jazz musicians especially, and from your dad, was the emotional power of the love of it, the joy of it, the involvement in it, the attachment to it. That's what I hear when I listen to you, that's what stood out over and over again, the pleasure, the joy, the love, the excitement that you saw in your dad and in the players that mostly captured you. And that, it seems to me, also captured you.
Leonard Bernstein, I recently was reading something where he was talking about the power of music, and Bernstein said, "Music has all the power." He felt that way. And as I read that, I thought, yes, that's the thing. It has all the power for me.
Yes, but people play without that. Some people play music or sing music or have music and they don't have that. But you saw that over and over again in your dad, in all of these, everybody that you talk about that. I can't find a word for it. Maybe just magic. The complete absorption and the pleasure that the music was giving the players. Does that not
seem? Yeah, it's why we have music, because it expresses everything that we can't with other things.
Yes. Okay, so we have you in high school. What did you do after that?
I went to State University of New York at Purchase because I could study there for credit with an accredited teacher. And that teacher at that time was a very important teacher to me. It was Jack Riley. My most important private teacher was Dick Hyman, who recommended Jack to me. See, my mother sent me to Dick Hyman's place when I was about 16. 15. I remember so well going over there. He lived at the Armory on West 42nd Street, the apartment house called that. And he had this incredible place where was two apartments. One had, I believe it had a Steinway piano, maybe two of them nested, it's possible, and an organ and all of this work that he did and music and albums and, you know, posters from everything that he'd done. And then you opened a door and it was like Dorothy when the house lands and she goes into Oz. It was an apartment, a beautiful apartment. Julia Hyman was an interior decorator and it felt like a completely homey, Hamisher place.
And they have exactly the same thing now.
Yes.
Houses.
Indeed. Well, even better. It's the Hyman compound down
yes,
there.
Yes, it is.
Really
yes.
Is something. So, and they've always had that, you know, that separation of their worlds that are together and separate, and it's beautiful. And she's an artist too. I went there and I remember playing for him and saying, you know, I wanted to study with him. He said, I know I can't take you on as a student because I'm too busy and you need a teacher who is there to give you assignments and to see you weekly. At the same time, he took me everywhere with him. You know, he said, I'm doing a record date today. I'm going to be playing with Twyla Tharp, a dance company. I'm going to be doing a film score. I'm doing a jazz date. I'm playing at a jazz festival. And he would take me along with him and I would watch as a fly on the wall, you know. But he said, I want you to go to Jack Riley. And Jack was a heavyweight. He knew Lester Young and Armstrong and Bill Evans. I mean, knew the music of, and knew Bill personally, of course. Schoenberg and Harmony Lehrer. And it was intense studying with him. So I started at the end of high school now with Jack. And I went to SUNY Purchase so I could continue to study with Jack. And I went to the classical program, again, not to be a classical musician, just to get a full box of tools. And that was great because I played with opera singers and I played organ music and I had piano literature and all of that kind of stuff. I was always a fan of classical music. You know, even my friends in high school, I knew the repertoire sometimes better than they did just as a fan, more like a DJ than I was thinking about playing it. But anyway, and I do remember one very important thing that Dick did at that first meeting. And this is typical of his generosity and quiet generosity. And to me, almost extraterrestrial dolphin-like intelligence.
Yes.
The full piano score of Porgy and Bess. After I played, he said, do you have this? I said, no, I don't. He said, here. He gave it to me. Uh-huh. The very first thing he gave to me. You know, it's funny. As I speak about this, it really does get emotional for me. Okay. You know, the book, The Giving Tree of Shel Silverstein.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's what he has been to me.
You are obviously incredibly lucky to have him. And I would guess that he was glad to do it.
Well, I'm lucky. So then I went to purchase for a couple of years. My uncle, who was anything but a musician, my father had passed away when I was very young. I was 7 years old. And my uncle, who was a major businessman, he was the chairman of Savin at a time. You know, he was a Daddy Warbucks kind of guy, landing helicopters in his backyard kind of stuff, flying them himself, that sort of stuff. He had a seaplane. I mean, he lived in Larchmont on the water, you know, next to Jerry Tsai, who was the CEO of Coca-Cola. So that's where he was headed. And was, you know, but there was zero art and music in his body. Zero.
Your father's brother?
Yes.
Wow.
And my father was nothing but music and art.
Wow.
So, but my uncle was very interesting. He understood that, you know, that this is what I was doing. And so he was footing the bill at the time for me to go to college because my folks didn't have the dough for it. And I started to realize that going to college was now in my way. That is, it was great that I was studying all of the things I was there, but I needed to be spending all day with Bud Powell and Art Tatum and Richard Rodgers and Duke Ellington.
Wow.
I needed to do that. And I knew that I couldn't be now spending time with things that, all due respect to Henry Purcell and Samuel Barber at this point. I remember calling my uncle and saying, I'm going to leave school. I need to leave school and practice. And he flew off the handle and went nuts. He said, and the way he was, he said, I remember he it's typical of my uncle. And he was like that kind of guy, you know, so intense. He put me on the phone with one of his business partner said, Billy, I want you to talk to Vic Satinsky. Okay, Paul. And he gets on the phone. Billy, what your uncle feels is that, and I'm thinking, this is like a movie. This is ridiculous. But I explained it to him. I said, look, it's not that I don't want to study. It's that I really need to study and I'm self-motivated at this point. So my uncle helped me rent an apartment on 200th Street, way uptown. It was a fifth floor walk-up. My brother lived there already. It was inexpensive. It was like $100 a month or $200 or something like that between me and my bro. In the meantime, I rented a piano from Steinway. See, I had grown up on a Baldwin Acrosonic because my father didn't care about a piano. Mm-hmm. He cared about getting the music out. You know, it wasn't about playing the piano, but I wanted a Steinway, which I still have. It's over there. My brother, who's a bass player, needed to practice too. In this apartment, I moved in, put the bed in my room. I got a carpet remnant the size of the piano and built a platform for the piano, which soundproofed it. I went down to Canal Foam and Rubber and I filled it with shredded foam. And then we nailed the platform, and then I put all these boxes of records, liquor boxes of records, you know, underneath. And I had a file cabinet to the side and a cozy chair, like an Archie Bunker chair, but not with his aesthetic, obviously. I put acoustical foam on the walls that looked like egg crates, you know, and we built a second door between the door of the room and my brother's room, which had an alcove about the size of two human beings to soundproof it. And I practiced. I would wake up early in the morning and I would look out the window and then it was dark. And that's what I did. And I did that for about, you know, a couple years. But within those couple of years, I was taking the train downtown And going to hear people like Kenny Barron and Tommy Flanagan at places like Lush Life and the Village Gate and Knickerbocker and Bradley's and the Village Vanguard when I could, you know, just standing on the steps. And then I'd come back uptown and practice. And I was studying now with a great pianist called Eleanor Hancock, who was a concert pianist. I was doing that for my technique and for sound at the piano. She taught me all about how to make sound and technically how to approach it. She was a protege of Dorothy Taubman, who is an important classical piano icon. And she's a very important innovator. Anyway, I was studying with Eleanor Hancock at that time. And after a couple of years, I was starting to get gigs wherever I could with my brother and take anything that I could. I had already been working. I mean, when I was in my teens in high school, my first gig, I was maybe 15 years old and I played 2 Bond Street. It was called the First Amendment Theater Company. And it was like an actor's studio approach to improvisation, taking suggestions from the audience. And, you know, people like Robin Williams would drop in and work with them. And it was, and that was a rarity, but that would happen. And it was a place for these actors to say to an agent, oh, come down and see me over here. Well, for me, it was really great because I could play as people were filing in, and I could play anything from Scott Joplin to Tad Dameron to Keith Emerson, anything I wanted, which gave me a chance to do that. I made $10 a show, and during the show, I was rather like a silent movie pianist. You know, anything that was happening on stage, I had to underscore. So that was a fabulous experience. But back to now I'm out of school. And I'm staying up there with my brother, and I'm starting to get little gigs here and there, restaurants and things, you know. And I had met the pianist Bill Mays. I'd been a great fan of his, and I had met him on a New York City street fair on Columbus Avenue. And he invited me up to his place. He was living now in the West 70s, and he had a Steinway piano and a Fender Rhodes set up. And I remember we read through some Horace Silver music, and he said, you know, I'm playing with Jerry Mulligan's quartet, and I'm going to be leaving soon. I think I'm going to recommend you for it.
Oh, my God.
I said, well, I'm not ready to do that. He said, well, I think you are. And so I went and auditioned for Jerry. And I remember there was one other pianist that auditioned. But, you know, it's funny. Jerry always shot for 42nd Street and overshot and ended up on 52nd Street. That's what he always said. And we got on like a house on fire because I understood him in a way, you know, and there were many things that brought that around. I mean, I really can see, it may sound like magical thinking, but there's a hand of the divine as I'm telling you this, because I see Roland and Eddie Locke and 2 Bond Street and an actor who was called Ash Harlan at 2 Bond Street, who gave me these cassettes, and they were cassettes that were, it would say maybe Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers, Miles Davis Nonet, Jerry Mulligan Tentet. They were one tune of each of these incredible groups. But we're talking about if it was Horace and the Jazz Messengers, and that's when, before it was Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, was Horace Silver, Doug Watkins, Kenny Dorham, Hank Mobley, Art Blakey. I knew from that I needed to get every album with Art Blakey on it, every album with Doug Watkins, every album with Hank Mobley. They were like little seeds, you know? So that Jerry Mulligan, Miles Davis Nonet playing Godchild was on there. Now, then right after that was the Jerry Mulligan Tentet playing Godchild. And Jerry's playing it at the piano. Now, I just heard, I didn't know it was Jerry Mulligan or who that was or anything at the time. When I was 15, I didn't understand that yet. I knew who Miles Davis was. So here I am now. I'm in my 20s and I'm at Jerry Mulligan's place. And it's just interesting. And all of that.
You know what Bashir did, right?
I do.
That's what it sounds like.
a lot of that in my life, and I'm lucky to have had a lot of that.
Well, if it's by shared, it's not luck.
Right.
It was meant for you, and you were well, in the right place at the right time over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, you know, Duke Ellington talks about that in his autobiography, which is so wonderful. Music is My Mistress is so beautiful. And he talks about how every time he turned a corner, he would meet the right person who would turn him to the next corner somehow.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can't see it as you're doing it. Dick had presented me at JVC and at the 92nd Street Y as a young talent, you know. And that was, of course, wonderful for me. I remember being on a piano concert with Dick Hyman, Roger Kellaway, and Marion McPartland. And I was, you know, a little kid there. And boy, I was terrified. But I did my very best. And it was the first time I was written about in anything. Remember when Jazz Times was like a newspaper? before it was the glossy downbeat style of Jazz Times. And it was the first time I was written about by Ira Gittler, who became my good friend, you know. But that was, what an exciting thing. And I remember exactly what I played there at 92nd Street Y. I played Sonny Clark's Something Special, which was a G minor blues. And I also played Danny Boy, of all things. Why? Because it was Dick Hyman's piano arrangement of Danny Boy with all of his beautiful harmony in it. So those were the two things I played that I prepared for that concert. And I remember being so nervous the night before and being at Bill May's place and saying, I'm going to do this concert. And this is before or right about the time he must have recommended me to Jerry. And I remember he said, Charlap, don't go home and practice now. Go relax. You don't need to practice anymore. You know, he was always coming to tell me, live some life. Stop practicing. And so I remember that night I went to the movie theater and I saw Spaceballs, which was how I got my head together for the concert.
Yeah.
Of course, I went home and practiced.
Very wise. Very wise. You know, I interview people who make their living or their life within art. And you do both. It's clear that you not only make your living with music, but that it's your life. It's been your life since the two-fingered.
Right? Rachmaninoff.
Right, exactly, right? So I have one more question. And it is, would you just look back and tell me what it means to you, what it feels like, what you think about this life that you dedicated to music?
Well, that I'm blessed. That's all. I'm so lucky. It's so lucky. It's so lucky. But I have all these phenomenal blessings. My wife, who's a genius, and the best partner, and I admire her music so much. My mother, who's still here and totally vital, my sisters and brother, my children, Kenny Washington and Peter Washington, who are my musical brothers, Phil Woods, who I played with for all those years, my students at William Patterson University, who I hope that I'm nurturing in a way that's good for them. And what they give to me is so beautiful. I'm so proud of them and to see how they develop. My partner, William Patterson, Dr. David Dempsey, so many things. They're all Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, who was one of my best friends and as great of a mentor to me as Dick Hyman, another type of finishing school. What can I say? I'm really lucky. I'm really lucky. And I work very hard, but it's a joy to work, to have the ability to work hard like that, and to have, I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities. And, you know, a lot of times people see your career as this straight line, and they don't know all of the opportunities that were promised that didn't happen. And, you know, isn't it Winston Churchill? Try again, or something like that. Or the law of success is he or she who gets up again. You got to keep getting up. Or the Thomas Edison is, you know, it's the 10,000th try that you might get success. You know, you must persevere. Perseverance is so important. And, but I'm lucky I had people who believed in me to help me believe in me. And that is what I hope I can pass on.
I think that that is the perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Bill Sharma.
Thank you, Lynn. It's delightful to talk to you.
Same here.